Hi everyone, and welcome to this edition of the Lawdown. It's a little bit delayed and we apologise for that, but we've been a bit busy. We're here now and we've got a few things to talk to you about. My name is Beth Hale. I'm a partner at CM Murray and I'm joined today by my partner Emma Bartlett and our associate Kia Aoki. There have been quite a few things in the news recently which have attracted our attention, so we've tried to limit it to just four key topics. The first one is a cleaner who was allegedly dismissed for eating a leftover sandwich after a lawyer's meeting. The second is Mason Greenwood's potential rumoured return to the Man United team. Third is Christian Horner at Red Bull in the investigation into his conduct. And the fourth is a recent case where a sacked council worker has won a really large compensation award in a disability discrimination claim. So firstly, the case of the cleaner and the tuna sandwich. So a cleaner is apparently taking legal action against a city law firm for indirect race discrimination and unfair dismissal after she was allegedly fired for picking up a sandwich off a discarded platter after when she was cleaning a room after a meeting in a law firm in the city. She wasn't in fact employed by the law firm. She was employed by an agency they dismissed her apparently after a complaint from the solicitors that leftover sandwiches were not being returned to the firm. Although I think it's worth saying that the firm themselves has said that they didn't make a formal complaint and that they would be happy to have her continue to clean for them. So just get that in there. Basically she has admitted that she did eat the sandwich, which she thought would be discarded. And she was then let go by the agency who employed her for taking client property without authority or reasonable excuse. And the union who represents her has said not only was that unfair, but it was also discriminatory. They say that she was dismissed for, and she said, and they say that this is a routine and very common occurrence that people are dismissed, people in her kind of position are dismissed on trivial and discriminatory grounds. And that this would not have happened if she were English. She is from Ecuador. So I think the sort of key interesting points that come out of this are, and obviously it's a long way, it's in the very early stages of the claim, so we're a long way from actually getting any kind of outcome. But firstly, I think one really interesting point is the really apparently minor reason for a dismissal, that apparently the sandwich was worth about £1.50, I mean, if that, but yet she was dismissed. And I think we've had this, we've seen these kinds of cases before, where although it's not to do with the value of what has been taken, it's actually about the dishonesty involved in that, although it does seem ridiculous in this case, frankly, that someone would be dismissed when they've eaten a sandwich which would otherwise have gone in the bin. And query whether there was actually any dishonesty there and therefore whether it could constitute a fair ground for dismissal. The other thing is that one of the other points that I thought was interesting was that she's bringing a claim both against the agency, which was her employer, but also against the city law firm, which did not directly employ her. And I was just sort of trying to wrap my head around how she would have the standing to bring that claim. And if they did make a complaint against her, then she would say that that was discriminatory and or that she was in fact, she might try and link herself and say she was in fact employed by them, even if there was a sort of umbrella agency in between the two. And then thirdly, I think one of the things I was thinking about is how is that discrimination? She is from Ecuador, she's not British. But what I'm slightly struggling with is how in fact that they are going to frame their discrimination claim in this case, and how I can see why it might be unfair, but I slightly struggle to see how they're going to frame an actual discrimination claim. Are they going to say that she was treated less favorably? I don't think they can say that she was treated less favorably because she was Ecuadorian. I think it's going to be an indirect discrimination claim where they would say that they have a policy that anyone who steals a sandwich would be dismissed, but that has a disproportionate impact on people with a certain protected characteristic. And I suppose the protected characteristic here would be a migrant worker you can see that I'm struggling. So Emma, I don't know what you think about that.
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? I seem Because you're right, that they are right at the start of the litigation, that they've brought in Devonshire's, as you say, possibly on the basis that she could assert that she had employment status with them, although more likely on the basis that right at the start of the litigation, she may not know what communication, where the direction to remove her came from. And if the direction came from the third party that Total Clean had provided her to, then she will say, well, that direction is the discriminatory act. That's possibly how it's being linked in. I agree with you that it seems unlikely it's going to be less favourable treatment based on your nationality or ethnic origin. And the indirect discrimination claim is interesting in that it's going to have to be a disproportionate impact on her because of her ethnic origin or nationality, in that, and it will be a statistics-based argument, therefore. Identifying the PCP, the practice criteria policy, is going to be interesting.
Mm-hmm.
It's got to be an implied policy that anybody who takes something when cleaning, presumably that's quite an obvious one actually to imply, or there may be an express term, but yeah, statistically showing that the majority of the cleaning staff will be of a particular, well, is it going to be that they'll be of a particular nationality, or can they do the inverse argument that
they're not
non-white, non-white British?
English. Yeah, and what they're saying, part of what they're linking it to, I think, is her limited, that she speaks limited English. If she was not a Latin American with limited English, the complaint would not have been made. I don't know. It feels like a slightly tricky case to bring to me, but it's really interesting that, you know, it's drawing attention to the issue of sort of very low paid workers working in the offices of, you know, I'm making no comment about the specific solicitors here, but working in sort of fancy offices for city workers who are all extremely well paid. I think it's quite an interesting point to make, isn't it? And the union and people who supported her staged a protest outside the law firm's offices, didn't they? And so I think it's quite an interesting point to be made, whether it will actually progress as a claim, and whether we'll ever see an outcome to it. Who knows? But it's just thought it was an interesting one to think about.
Yeah, I mean, you obviously also have to think about, even if indirect discrimination is established, that has the measure taken, that the removal of her from the cleaning team, is that an objective justification? Or, you know, what is the objective justification? So it's an interesting case to watch in a creative way in order to protect rights.
Yeah, and to draw attention to some real issues, I think.
Yeah.
I think, Emma, your point about statistics being helpful to bring that kind of indirect discrimination claim is right. And it's going to be helpful for them that if they can show through the statistics that a particular race was disproportionately affected, they don't need to demonstrate why that particular group was disproportionately affected if they have the statistics to show that that's already in place. So I think that here might be particularly useful if they're struggling to come up with the whys.
Yeah, that's a really good point. It's that just the fact that they are disproportionately affected would suffice for the bringing of a claim, wouldn't it? Even the employer can't objectively justify. Yeah, interesting. So Kia, you're going to talk to us about Mason Greenwood.
Yes. I'm sure it's a story that everyone is already aware of in terms of the background, but in summary, Mason Greenwood is a football player at Manchester United, and he was arrested back in January 2022 on suspicion of raping and assaulting a woman. He was then suspended by Manchester United immediately after his arrest. And then the charges against Mason were later withdrawn in February 2023. Man U then conducted their own investigation, which culminated in a decision to loan him out to a Spanish team called Getafe for a season. and he's currently still playing there. The latest in this story is that the loan period is going to come to an end in the summer, and Man U are not looking to renew that loan, and therefore they need to make a decision about whether they're going to sell him or bring him back potentially to Manchester United. And one of the part owners of the club, Sir Jim Ratcliffe, has recently said that whilst a decision hasn't been made, he didn't rule out the possibility that Mason might be brought back to Manchester United, which is somewhat contrary to previous stances they've taken on that. It's obviously a very fraught and contentious issue, and I'm not proposing to comment on the specifics of his potential return, but I think this development is interesting from an employment law perspective in looking at how employers generally deal with situations where an employee returns to the workplace after an investigation where they have been exonerated or at least no adverse findings have been made against them. And there's clearly a number of challenges for an employer to deal with in this situation. From a cultural perspective, there could be challenges related to the perception of that person by other employees, difficulties in ensuring the work environment remains harmonious and amicable. There's also potential issues in how to ensure confidentiality of any investigation. I think that can be particularly difficult if the employee who's returned feels they have a need, feel like they need to defend themselves, or if there's a lot of gossip circulating about the matter. But it is important that confidentiality is upheld, and a breach of those obligations could be a disciplinary matter. So in the situation where an employee returns and the situation hasn't really resolved itself, there are a number of things that an employer can do to try to resolve things and move things forward. One of those is workplace mediation. That can be particularly effective if, for example, there's been a breakdown in relationships between employees, as it can allow a controlled channel of communication between the parties and find solutions that everyone involved agrees to. And it can also be a good forum for the individuals involved to express any concerns or disagreements they might have, which the employer wants to be aware of. Training is another potential option, either on the collective level, but also on an individual level for certain people, on the issues that gave rise to any misconduct allegations and to prevent them reoccurring in the future. Another option, which is more drastic, but if the situation did become untenable, there is potential for an employer to dismiss the employee on the grounds of some other substantial reason. That's generally quite a difficult limb to bring a dismissal on. But in this kind of situation, it's arguable that an employer could say that in regards to the PR and the reputational damage that retaining this employee is having, it could constitute a fair dismissal. I think in the Mason Greenwood matter, I think the PR side is one of the key considerations given the spotlight in the matter and how divisive it's been in the past. And I think specifically in the Manchester United situation, there are also going to be a number of other considerations, including the financial implications of keeping him or selling him. I read that Manu will only get 80% of his fee if he's sold elsewhere. There's also contractual considerations to think about. So those will all need to be weighed against the other factors, and then a decision will need to be made on that basis.
Such an interesting case, isn't it? And so tricky. I think one of the things I thought when I was reading this is the headlines all said Mason Greenwood might be coming back. And then you actually drill down into the article, and what he had said was, obviously, we will go through due process and consider what is appropriate in all the circumstances. And it said, you know, he'd actually, I think, said all the kind of right stuff about taking into account all the valid points that you've just made. So I think the sort of headlines which screamed out that Mason Greenwood was coming back were probably a little bit over sensational. I think there's a number of factors that make this case sort of particular and different to sort of those of a what you might call a normal employer. But one of them that particularly jumped out at me was that the Manchester United women's team had said that they didn't want Mason Greenwood. They had spoken out and said that they didn't want Mason Greenwood to come back. which I suppose is, you know, which is obviously a something that the club ought to think about and take into account. But there are also, I mean, there is so much on social media about this case, and people sort of with very strongly held views on both sides of the coin. And yeah, it's a really interesting one.
Yeah, exactly. I think then there's been the situation with Anthony as well. Man, you really have their work cut out for them in you know, trying to come to what could be, you know, trying to come to the right decision, given that increased focus on them.
Yeah, and I think also just trying to change the sort of perception of football as a sort of misogynist. And I say that as someone who's a big football fan, but as a sort of kind of misogynist place to be. And, you know, I think there are all sorts of factors they ought to be considering around how fans feel going to their stadium, how, you know, I think, you know, it's a really complicated situation, isn't it? So, we'll see what decision they come to. Emma, Christian Horner, another really interesting sports story.
Thank you. I've been watching this progress through the news at the moment, the story of the internal investigation into allegations of inappropriate behaviour by Christian Horner at Red Bull Racing. It's caught the headlines for a number of reasons. He obviously Red Bull are doing really well in the sport at the moment. Christian Horner married to Jerry Halliwell, former Spice Girl. So it's all very newsworthy, isn't it? And it's the news that there was these allegations made. An independent barrister was commissioned by the employer to investigate the allegations. And the investigation was undertaken really quickly. Quite often it can take a long time, particularly where there are a number of allegations being made. For the investigation to be completed, let alone the independent report provided then to the employer, so the employer can take a decision as to what next steps there might be. But in this case, we saw that the investigation happened quickly. It appeared to be independent, and it found that the allegations were not sustained. The interesting thing for me is that clearly there's a couple of things. Firstly, during the investigation, Christian Horner was quite often criticised for still remaining in the workplace whilst the investigation was being undertaken, given the fact that the nature of the allegations appeared to be serious. And we don't know what the allegations are, other than it's allegations of inappropriate behaviour. So that's something to discuss, whether or not it was right for the employer to keep him there. He was obviously critical to Red Bull's success and ongoing success at the moment. And he's very senior in the organisation. And then the other thing is that clearly the outcome of the investigation isn't one that the complainant is able to accept, because very publicly we know that she has appealed. Secondly, she's referred it to the regulator, which of course is her right to have done so at any point. And then thirdly, we understand that she sent details of her allegations to a number of other multiple individuals in the racing community. So she went external with it, which has resulted in her herself being subjected to disciplinary action. So if I was to look at the whether or not he should have been suspended, as I said, we don't know what the allegations are, but there are limited grounds on which employers should suspend, and it shouldn't be a knee-jerk reaction to any allegation against the individual that they should be suspended. Employers should only suspend ordinarily where they've got a right to do so under the contract, but in order to avoid breaching that implied term of trust and confidence, they still need to act reasonably, even if there is a contractual right to do it. Or it may be something that's inserted into the disciplinary policy when an investigation is being undertaken. But in order to be seen to be acting reasonably, the case law suggests there are just a couple of grounds on which somebody should reasonably be suspended. And the first one is whether their presence in the workplace is going to hamper the investigation in some way. And that is, will witnesses be open, forthcoming and truthful if the individual is still in the workplace? Or secondly, would they be in some way destroying evidence? And in this case, it seems unlikely that there was evidence to be destroyed, but there might be an allegation that, and I know nothing about the investigation, but sometimes where you have a senior individual who's accused of something, their very presence in the workplace on an ongoing basis might be something which would hamper a witness coming forward, perhaps, or wanting to be candid with the investigator. So I guess that's the basis on which his presence in the workplace could be criticised. But then you have, if you're looking at it from his point of view, well, he's saying disciplinary investigation is not to be equated with disciplinary action. I am innocent until proven otherwise, and therefore my right to work should not be impacted. And as long as there was some assurance that he wasn't doing anything to hamper the investigation. Depends how detailed the investigation was, and the briefness of the investigation could be something that is criticised on appeal. So I just thought that was really interesting.
It's interesting, isn't it, that they have suspended her, but they have not suspended, but they did not suspend him. So you wonder what the how they've reached those two very different decisions.
Well, I guess from her perspective, because she's gone external, and I don't mean external to the regulator, but she's sent what is confidential information for the purposes of the ongoing investigation, because she has appealed, but she sent that to other people within the racing community. Then if she was perhaps allowed to remain in the business, there is that fear that she could cause damage to the business, which is another ground on which you can suspend. And obviously they didn't feel that there was a risk that Christian Horner remaining in the business would cause damage to the business.
Yeah, it feels that there's a sort of disparity there, doesn't there? But without knowing the details of their decision making process, obviously impossible to say. But
yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's the difference in seniority there is quite stark.
Yeah.
I would hope that the employer took very serious consideration before deciding to suspend her, because the allegation of this is retaliation or victimisation is otherwise going to be quite strong. But she did send things external and query whether she has put herself into the category of a whistleblower or lost that protection by going outside of the internal process too early.
Yeah, as ever with the sort of stories we read in the press, there's a lot of unknowns, aren't there? So a lot of speculation to be done. And then finally, we were going to talk about the council worker who has just this week received, it's been announced that she's been awarded, I think, £4.6 million in compensation in a disability discrimination claim. And obviously that jumps out as a really unusually high award. And Emma, you were just going to talk to us about why it's so big and what the sort of key features were.
Absolutely. This involves the London Council worker. He was senior in the she was the former director of public sector reform at London Borough of Hammersmith and Fulham, and she was dismissed from her £125,000 a year job in 2018 while she was on sick leave with secondary post-traumatic stress disorder. She had developed the condition whilst assisting survivors of the dreadful Grenfell Tower disaster. So unsurprising that somebody might suffer PTSD. And she was off sick at the relevant time. She also had disclosed to her employer that she had ADHD, which was a compounding factor in the matter. But the eye-catching size of the award is the thing that we just don't see these £4.6 million being awarded, especially to somebody who is, I don't know, again, I'm making a supposition, but if we assume that she's in her mid-30s, and apologies if I've got that very wrong, but if we assume she's in her mid-30s, ordinarily an employment tribunal would expect somebody to be able to recover from discrimination and an unfair dismissal and rejoin the working community.
Can I just chip in? I think she's 52, but still, I think the same.
That's all right, then. I've done her some favours. But yeah. 52, even so. So there is an argument of somebody who's 52 would still have 15 years left of their working life. And whilst it may take them some time, actually, this was in 2018, so 20 years left of their working life. And of course, it would take them some time to get over the dismissal in circumstances where she brought multiple discrimination claims. She also brought a whistleblower claim, actually, which did not succeed at first instance. The size of the award, though, is based on the fact that she must have produce significant medical evidence to demonstrate that she would not be returning to the workplace, or if she was, she would not be earning anywhere near the higher salary that she was earning back in 2018 of $125,000 a year, plus presumably there's a few benefits in there, but what the significant benefit that I think will have impacted the level of this award will have been pension. For an individual to be out of work for 15 or 20 years earning a salary like that, you can quite quickly get up to a multi-million pound loss of earnings claim. You know, the cherry on top of the cake, though, would have been calculations for her pension loss arising out of not being able to rebuild your pension or carry on building your pension for 15 to 20 years. And there are, that in itself takes some significant calculations, but that's how you would have got up to 46, 4.6 million. The need for medical evidence cannot be underestimated in seeking loss beyond what the employment tribunal's expectations would normally be for somebody who has suffered even the most serious type of discrimination. And ordinarily, as a rule of thumb, I would say that the tribunal would not look to compensate beyond a year. So to get beyond a year, even to 2 or 3 years, the medical evidence has to be compelling. But to get to career loss, we don't see this very often. The career loss cases in the employment tribunal will have, we have seen them where somebody has been in the armed forces, for instance, and is unable to, there's only one place in the UK that you can get that career. So if you've lost your career in the armed forces and you're unable to return to it, then of course, there will be career loss. There will be some mitigation in there if you're able to turn your hand to something else. But as I said, it's rare to see career loss in the UK, which is why it's been so attention grabbing. I did read the Employment Tribunal judgment, which was a really good, I would recommend it to anybody who enjoys reading reading judgments, because it really carefully sets out the reasoning and the judicial tests that they have to consider, presumably so well set out with a view that if an appeal, which of course the council has intimated that it's going to appeal, but if it gets to the Employment Appeals Tribunal, no employment judge wants their decision to be criticised by the next tribunal. So, but I can recommend it to you.
And wasn't one of the features that the tribunal found that the witnesses for the council have been dishonest in the witness stand?
Yeah, and that resulted in another head of loss, and I don't know what amount was awarded in respect. So I'm assuming the bulk of the compensation is in relation to loss of earnings, including pension loss. But she will have had, because of the nature of the injury, she will have had some general damages, injury to feelings award. But because of the dishonesty in the council's evidence, it could have also led to exemplary damages, which again is not something that is commonly seen in employment tribunal cases. We haven't got the judgment, the published judgment of the quantum hearing, to know exactly what it is that was awarded in that respect. But that will have compounded the issue.
Yeah, and is a sort of salutary lesson, isn't it? And not lying when you're giving evidence, sort of should go without saying, but doesn't always.
Yeah, the exemplary damages is there. There's very few in the employment tribunal system damages that can be awarded against an employer for a pure penalisation of the act that's happened. But exemplary damages is one of those.
Yeah. And it is often sort of threatened, but actually rarely awarded. So it's really interesting to see a case, and I look forward to reading the quantum judgment.
Yeah. If the witness, if there was deception in the way that the respondents gave their evidence as well, that could have led to, and I haven't seen this published in the news, but that could have led to a costs award, an adverse cost award against the council, which again are the exception rather than the norm. And I can imagine that the costs were pretty weighty in this case.
Yeah, it's an interesting one. Excellent. So thanks, Emma. Thanks, Kia. Thanks, everyone, for listening. And if you want more information, do check out our website, cm-murray.com. And do feel free to get in touch if there are subjects you'd like us to cover in our next edition of the Lawdown. Thanks.
Thank you, Beth.
Thanks.
Thank you.